Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
The soil in Iowa is the richest in the world. There was a time when owning 1,000 acres of that soil, planted in corn and soybeans, meant power and prosperity. Times have changed.
The realities of modern farm life and the problems that arise when the family farm is passed from one generation to the next.
From Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Storylines Midwest. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor. Today, the plight of the Midwestern family farm and Jane Smiley with her story of 1,000 acres.
And we'd like to hear from you with your stories and your questions at 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762.
It's Storylines Midwest. The Midwest was settled by immigrants. Germans, Scandinavians, and others came here looking for a better life.
If you head down an old dirt road near Baraga in Michigan's Upper Peninsula and drive through a forest to the end of the road, you'll find yourself at an old Finnish homestead. The Hanka homestead is now a museum, but in the early part of the 20th century, it was a working pioneer farm.
Here's the main barn. Look at it. Notice the heavy timbers on the floor.
Ruben Niemista gives tours and tells visitors how the farm once operated.
They had 3 cows normally and a couple calves, and it was a subsistence farm. They'd have probably a vegetable garden, and of course potatoes was a staple. They'd have a potato field because everybody raised their own potatoes in those early days.
The story of these pioneers is a typical one. The Hankas came from Finland and settled in Michigan, but they just as easily could have come from Germany and settled in Iowa, or from Norway to Minnesota. It was the Homestead Act of 1862 that encouraged pioneer families like this one to settle the West and the Midwest.
Their dream was to own land. They were poor, they were paupers, you know, this in Finland, and when they got to this country, their ambition was to be like the big landowners, you know, where they had hundreds of acres of land and scores of people that used to work for about $30 a year. And they looked upon land ownership as the ultimate goal in life. This was the last 80 acres here, so this is why they were here.
But no matter where farmers settled in the Midwest, life was hard. Homesteads were often far from town, winters were cold, summers hot, and the bugs were overwhelming. Some farms succeeded, and some did not.
Jane Smiley's novel, 1,000 Acres, is the fictional saga of a farming family whose ancestors succeeded in taming the land.
All this land was underwater, every last bit of it, the first time my great-grandfather came out here, Jane. It took him 25 years to lay the tile and dig the drainage wells. No machines. Did it all by hand. No such thing as luck.
They made their own.
The novel 1,000 Acres is based on the story of King Lear, but in this case, the kingdom is 1,000 acres of land in Iowa. The story is told from the perspective of Ginny, the oldest daughter, who, even as a child, knew how her family had conquered the land.
There was no way to tell by looking that the land beneath my childish feet wasn't the primeval mold I read about at school, but it was new, created by magic lines of tile my father would talk about with pleasure and reverence. Tile drew the water, warmed the soil, and made it easy to work, enabled him to get into the fields with his machinery a mere 24 hours after the heaviest storm. Most magically, tile produced prosperity. More bushels per acre of a better crop, year after year, wet or dry. I knew what the tile looked like. When I was very young, 5 or 12 inch cylinders of real tile always lay here and there around the farm for repairs or extension of tile lines. As I got older, tile became long snakes of plastic tubing. But for years, I imagined a floor beneath the topsoil checkered aqua and yellow like the floor in the girls' bathroom at the elementary school. a hard, shiny floor you could not sink beneath. Better than a trust fund, more reliable than crop insurance, a farmer's best patrimony. It took John and Sam and, at the end, my father a generation, 25 years, to lay the tile lines and dig the drainage wells and cisterns. I, in my Sunday dress and hat driving in the Buick to church, was a beneficiary of this grand effort, someone who would always have a floor to walk on. However much these acres looked like a gift of nature or of God, they were not. We went to church to pay our respects, not to give thanks.
Ginny's father decides to divide the land among his three daughters, but the youngest sister, Caroline, hesitates to accept her share and she's cut out of the will. The battle over the inheritance that ensues divides the family and reveals the dark secrets of their past. Ginny and the middle sister, Rose, were victims of incest. Through court battles, memories of their troubled past, divorce, and death, A Thousand Acres stays grounded in the daily facts of farm life, the division of labor, the seasonal rotation of jobs, and the details of getting crops to market. The sisters don't speak to each other for years, and although the wounds can never fully heal, they're brought back together in the end by the blood they share and the land that holds them.
Jane Smiley has written many novels, ranging from Moo, an academic satire set in a Midwestern university, to one of my personal favorites, Greenlanders, a historical novel that crosses several generations of Scandinavian farmers in medieval Greenland, long ways from Iowa. But she won the Pulitzer Prize in 1991 for the novel we're talking about today, A Thousand Acres. Jane Smiley is with us now, and we'd like to hear from you, too, with your questions and stories. The number to call is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. Hello, Jane.
Hi, how are you? But Greenland isn't actually all that far from Iowa.
I guess we could go further, couldn't we? You first went to Iowa. You came there as a graduate student, if I have the biography right.
Yes.
And that was in the early 70s?
Yes. I got to Iowa in 1972.
Okay. And was that your first contact with the Midwest?
No, I was raised in St. Louis, Missouri, and they don't really think of themselves as part of the Midwest, but they are.
But they are. And so you didn't really have any preconceptions. Iowa was what you expected it to be.
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Do you have first impressions, though, when you got to the state?
Well, you know, I drove north from Missouri. I'd spent the summer in St. Louis, and I was struck, as I always was when I crossed that border, at how beautifully groomed all the farms in Iowa were, and how you really did feel that you were going from a place in the south to a place in the north. And it's partly having to do with landscape, but it also has to do with just the general history of the two areas.
Now, the farming detail in Thousand Acres is so rich, and it seems to cover so many different aspects of farming. Did you know much about farming before you started working on the book?
Well, yes and no. I'd lived in Iowa since 1972. I'd read the Des Moines Register. I'd been interested in farming. I'd asked a lot of questions. I rented a little farmhouse in a town near a town called Keokuk, which is south of Iowa City. So I wasn't, as it were, professionally interested in farming, but I was I was interested as a kind of avocation. I walked around the roads, I looked at the farms, and my interest grew, but I'd always had a kind of interest in rural life and in farming.
So you were living in Keokuk during the 80s then, is that right?
Well, no. We lived in Keokuk for 1 year. Then I lived in various places around Iowa City, where I was going to graduate school. And then in 1981, we moved from West Branch, Iowa, which is where Herbert Hoover was from and was also a farm town. We moved there from there to Ames, which is in some sense more where the novel is set. Central Iowa is quite different, both in terms of landscape and in terms of immigrant patterns. than Eastern Iowa or Iowa City is.
So,
I'm sorry, go on.
So you were in Iowa though during the big farm crisis of the 80s.
Yes, I was. Yes,
that was a very dramatic time. What were your impressions as you sort of watched that go on?
Well, it was scary, you know, because things had been pretty good and the interest rates had gone up, and suddenly the farmers were really caught between the fact that their land prices were as high as they'd ever been, but the interest rate on the loans they needed to take to put in a crop were also astronomical, that, you know, in the 12 to 14% range. And so they were quite kind of caught between the hammer and the anvil. And really the land prices had were kind of an illusion. People felt like they had a whole lot of money, but in fact they were cash poor because the land wasn't producing enough cash flow in order to support itself. But I felt at the time, or I felt in retrospect, that these are things that a lot of people don't realize. You know, people aren't very, the average person isn't very sophisticated in his economic theory. And if someone says, well, your land is worth $3 million, then it's very tempting to borrow on the equity that you have in that land and to think you're going to earn it back somehow. But they got to the point where huge surpluses and huge crops really drove down the price that they were getting, and it was really a very difficult time.
And we have Jenny at the end of 1,000 Acres working extra hours in a restaurant to put in her $200 a month for tax payments or something. Yeah, what does she call it? The mortgage on her regret?
She had, of course, would have had to have paid capital gains on the inheritance of the farm, and she wasn't able to recover it, so she has to pay her pittance, whatever it is, in order to sort of pay off her tax bill.
Well, I was growing up in Iowa during the 80s, during the big farm crisis, and I sort of remember just this sense of dread all the time. There were the bumper stickers that said, "The last person out of Iowa, please turn out the lights." Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of for sale signs. I lived out in the country, a lot of for sale signs on farms, a lot of foreclosures, and even a lot of suicides at the time. Do you remember what the feeling was? I mean, you were at an agricultural university at the time.
Well, the feeling was, well, what possibly could go wrong? You know, there were some killings. There was a man, a farmer, who killed a banker south of Iowa City just out of frustration. There were suicides. I think people just didn't understand how to, or the farmers and the bankers, were sort of really crushed between that sudden interest rate hike and the sudden fall in crop prices. And if they didn't have like a hog operation or some kind of sideline, they had a very difficult time, first of all, keeping the family farm, and second of all, talking about it. It doesn't come naturally to farmers to admit defeat or to talk about what's going on. And so they would, you know, be overburdened with this tension and this fear, but they did not believe in expressing it to their neighbors or hardly even to their families. And so you can imagine, one time I had a class, a creative writing class, and a person in one of the students' stories had something that was an internal crisis. And I asked the students in the class what she should do. And all the ones from outside of the Midwest said, oh, they should go to a therapist or talk about it or get into a group or something. And all the ones from the Midwest said, oh, they should keep it to themselves.
Do you think that's typical of Midwestern attitudes?
I don't know if it is anymore, but it certainly was. Very stoic, very attempt to work it out oneself, because it's shameful to complain and to appear weak, I think.
Mm-hmm. This whole sort of sense of when the King Lear Association in A Thousand Acres, when you sort of this grand tragedy that is laid over mm-hmm. this farm family, I'm real curious about, just a part of me that's a book guy, is real curious about what came first. I mean, did you have the story and think the Lear story could somehow shape the story you were working on? Or did you think, oh, all this stuff that's happening in Iowa sounds like tragedy and I can associate it with King Lear? I'm kind of curious as to where was the chicken and where was the egg and all that.
Well, for me, the Lear story came first. I had read King Lear in high school and college, and I had always been interested in those two older sisters, Goneril and Regan. Mm-hmm. And I had always, in some sense, disagreed with the standard interpretation of the play. And then one day I was driving from Minneapolis south through northern Iowa on Highway 35. I looked around, and it was about late March, and then it was just very bleak. And I said, you know, this is where you could set King Lear if you wanted to rewrite it from the point of view of the sisters. But at that point, and that would have been 88 maybe, I'd been living in Iowa for about 16 years. So I was quite familiar with the world of farming and the way that people talked about farming and with the farm crisis, and it all just gelled right there.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest, and we're talking today with Jane Smiley, who's the author of A Thousand Acres. We'd love to hear from you, too, with your questions, with your comments, with your reflections on rural life. 866-255-2762 is the number to call. 866-255-2762. Jane,
I'd like to say one little thing, and that is that the novel takes place in 1979. Farming has changed considerably even since then. I think in 1979, people still felt that the family farm in the Midwest was a viable way to produce agricultural commodities, and that there was still hope for the family farm. I think in 2001 that people don't feel that anymore, and it's really a shame that has happened. But the forces of what you might call industrial farming have just overwhelmed the land and the families, and I think it's too bad.
Okay, well, it's a shame. Well, what have we lost in that then, Jane? What do you think we've lost?
Well, the ideal family farmer, let's take the grandfather of a friend of mine who used to live in Des Moines on his family farm, named Craig Canine. He lived on a 160-acre farm that his grandfather had farmed, and his grandfather had raised five kids and sent them to college on the proceeds of that farm, which was a rather hilly farm. It wasn't a beautiful flat farm the way you get north of Des Moines. But by the time that Craig was ready to farm and live on that farm, the farm sucked away everything he earned as a writer and doing other things, just because you could no longer make enough profit on any kind of a piece of property or any kind of a crop that wasn't huge, you know. Mm-hmm. But the problem with having such a huge farm is that the farmer really can't pay too much attention to the land. He can't keep the stream courses. He can't keep the windbreaks. He can't keep the bushes where the birds nest. When the birds and insect life go away, then pollination becomes difficult for all the crops that aren't like corn, you know, that are pollinated by the wind or whatever. And so the ecosystem of the whole area just declines and declines because there's no person like the family farmer who's really paying close attention to each part of his farm and saying, well, is this what I should do here and is this what I should do here? He might not have the wherewithal to terrace 2,000 acres. He might have the wherewithal to terrace a couple hundred acres. So the landscape is more subject. I'm not saying that it inevitably degrades, but it's more subject to degradation if if there are fewer people paying attention to each acre. And that you just can't do it any other way if you have 1,000 or 2,000 acres and you're farming with very large air-conditioned machines. It's very hard if you don't have really hands-on people in the family paying attention to what's going on with each part of the land. And to me, that's the biggest thing that's happened on the land. It's not the biggest thing that's happened in the, what you might say, in the economic system, but it is the biggest thing that's happened on the land, just the depopulation of the group of people who is farming.
To join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-255-2762, and Tom is on the line in Wisconsin. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Hello. What would you like to talk about?
Oh, I'd just like to say I really enjoyed the book. To be honest, I haven't got all the way through the book, but I saw the movie twice.
Good.
With Jason Robards and Michelle Pfeiffer. And I just wanted to say I was born on a Wisconsin dairy farm, and I always like stories about the farm, especially contemporary stories. I cringed about the incest. I hope that, quotation mark, city slickers don't think that much of the incest goes on out here in, in rural Wisconsin or Iowa. Although in our close-knit, community, there was a incident of incest in the, when I was growing up. I was about 12 years old, and I just thought that, this was the first time I ever heard of such a thing, and I thought it was it struck me as just an unimaginable, unspeakable crime against a child. Anything like this is, it really affects a children molestation or incest is just, it stays with them their whole life with or without therapy. It seems to me like Rose and Jenny would be even more affected than in the book. They'd be even more affected than probably within the book if you comment on that.
Yes, well, thank you, Tom. Jane, I mean, it's a central question, and part of me that comes from a farm too thinks, oh no, is she just going to have all these slitty slickers think this about the farm? And then part of me goes, well, this is part of the human condition, and this is the way it is. But I was always go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's not just part of. It's not exactly part of farm life. It's a part of the life of families that are isolated. And it almost doesn't matter what isolates them. But it after I wrote the book and a lot of people said to me, you think what's bad and you think that was bad in that novel, you should hear what happened to me on the farm. A lot of people wrote me letters like that. For me, the incest theme came from not so much from farming, though I felt it was plausible in a community where the people were widely spread, it came more from the dynamic of the play.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the father in the play was so willing to cross the boundaries of the daughters and to demand, what you might call too much care on the part of the daughters. I felt he was very patriarchal and a narcissist and a strong mm-hmm. narcissist.
Like Lear.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's how I came to the incest theme. At the same time, I feel that the imposition of industrialized farming upon the landscape of the Midwest is could be symbolized by that kind of cruel exploitation of the female members of the society. So I wanted also to use it symbolically and to say that what Larry was doing was wholesale in his life. Mm-hmm. He was treating the land in a certain way. He was treating his daughters in a certain way. He was using them all, everything, as instruments for his own ends.
Near the end of the book, when Ginny's working in the restaurant and Ty comes to visit her, she says, I mean, I know Ginny's your character and doesn't speak for you, even though sometimes we like to think that she does. Oh, that's Jane Smiley. But Ginny's talking to Ty, and she talks about this is all part of the same package, abusing the children, over-farming the land, depleting the topsoil, using too many pesticides and poisoning the groundwater. She says that's the way those farmers were trained to be.
It's not just farmers. It's the application of any kind of a system to the natural world that exploits it and takes it out of the realm of the sacred and puts it just into the realm of a natural exploitable resource. And this seems to be a characteristic of Western European thinking, at least from the time of Descartes. You know, people would just, starting around that time, the time of Bacon and Descartes, thinkers simply said, oh, look what we've got. We can just do it. We can take it apart. We can inspect it. We can look at it. It doesn't have any real sacred quality. And so we can use it for our own ends. And to me, this is what you might call a spiritual and philosophical failure of Western thinking. And it expresses itself in the way that people farm, but it also expresses itself in the way that people treat animals or treat the land or treat the atmosphere, treat the water supply, whatever. And it's something that we now in 2001 have to deal with all the time. We have to deal all the time with an environment that has been degraded by being objectified.
So when you look ahead to the future, and we're going to talk a lot more about the future of the family farm coming up in the next half hour, but when you look ahead to the future, do you think that being more environmentally aware is the only way for farming to continue?
Well, you know, we have to differentiate between farming and food production.
Mm-hmm.
People don't have to be environmentally aware in order to produce food. And the evidence of that is that there's plenty of food that's being produced even as we speak, you know, right here in California, right there in Iowa, whatever. But they do, it seems to me, have to be more environmentally aware to produce a world, a rural life in a rural world that is tolerable, that is good rather than just... a factory.
Well, stay with us, Jane. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Jane Smiley is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning 1,000 Acres. Her most recent book is Horse Heaven. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 866-255-2762, and we are going to be exploring the future of the family farm and rural life as it is now. More in the next half hour. For more information on Storylines Midwest or the books we're reading, you can visit our website, storylines.ala.org, or you can check out your local public library. Participating libraries have copies of the books, program schedules. They also have our discussion guides. You're listening to Storylines Midwest.
Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
Well, it's been bone dry for a month or so. It stays this way and the crops won't grow. Us small-time farmers sure got life tough. It either rains too much or not enough, and the corn's been stunted. The wheat won't sow. Cows are thirsty, so the milk won't flow. When the creek went dry, the fish went too. If it rained today, we might not make it through. And it looks like stone soup is all we'll get. Till the rains come round to make this dust bowl wet. You could stare at the sky for the rest of your life and eat only stone soup with a pocket knife.